Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today it's James Rebanks talking about the shepherd's life.
Good afternoon. Can everybody hear okay? I assume that everything's going to go wrong because every time I touch a piece of technology it falls to pieces or stops working. So I'm going to start off with a quiz. Put your hand up if one of your grandparents was a farmer. Okay. Put your hands up if one of your parents was a farmer. Still pretty good. Put your hand up if you're a farmer. Which leads to two conclusions. One, it's lovely to see so many farmers. Hello. And two, my usual thing about farmers being a disappearing species doesn't work in Wiltshire. So. And while I'm at it, when I came into the showground about an hour ago, I had a quick look around and I thought it was the worst agricultural show I'd ever been to because there are no sheep, no cattle. I couldn't see the sheep pens, but there's lots of marquees. It felt like the livestock hadn't got here yet. Joking aside, despite that not working at all, when I do that usually in most places, even most places around the world that I've been lucky enough to go to, the hands disappear with each passing generation. About 30% of the hands disappear with each passing of the generation. They didn't then, which is the first place I've ever been where they didn't go. And I think I'm probably, hopefully I wrote a quite nice book, but I think I'm lucky in a sense that I wrote about something which is part of a lot of people's past and it increasingly isn't part of their present. And I think a lot of people in the modern world are wondering what they lost. They know what they gained. They've got satellite TV, they've got very fancy phones, they've got good computers, they've got great healthcare. But I think people are wondering about how disconnected they've become from the land. That's where I live. I live in Matterdale in the Lake District. That's my dog, Tan. He was looking at me like he does look at me because he's probably about twice as intelligent as I am. And most of our work consists of him looking at me saying, no, no. There's some more sheep over the hill you don't know, and I can't tell you because I don't speak human. Bear with me. And that's the mountain, the heft, where my sheep go in the summer. That's where all of my ewes with single lambs are at the moment. For any of you that are climbers or know the Lake District really well, that's on the slopes of Great Dodd. And you're looking down into Douthat Head, which is one of the nicest valleys in the Lake District. And way over that rise, about 3 miles away, is where our farmstead is. And there are a few things you can say about that. The first one is I feel like I'm one of the luckiest people in the world. I love what I do. I love the place that I'm from. I'm proud of my family. And every day when I wake up, I think, you lucky bugger. Yeah? I look out the window and I think, Christ, you live in the best place there is. And it is very nice. I sometimes wonder if I'd been born in Ipswich or something. I'd probably think Ipswich was the nicest place on the planet because I'm that kind of person. I am somebody that maybe sees the positive in things and very rooted. I'm just going to do a little bit of a reading. Okay, I'm going to read you a little bit from the start of the book. When you write a book, you don't really imagine that it might have any kind of future life. You hope that somebody will read it. In an ideal world, lots of people will read it, and editors and other people will be happy. But you can't really imagine whether it means anything to anybody. And the passage I'm about to read was written when my father was dying. When I wrote the book 3 years ago now, my father was dying of cancer. And my dad actually hijacked the book. It was going to be one kind of book, and then as my father was dying, it became another kind of book. And despite having lots of love and interest from all those amazing editors, I lost interest in the editors about halfway through writing it, and I really wanted to write a letter to my dad. I wanted to tell my farming dad why I respected him and why I loved him and why all the things we'd been through I'd got over, and then it was just love and just respect. And I was very, very lucky to do that. And all of the nice things that have happened to me, don't cry, James, all of the nice things that have happened to me in terms of selling lots of books and lovely praise and all the rest of it, don't amount to a hill of beans in my heart beside the fact that I got to tell my dad that I loved him and respected him. He read the book about 3 weeks before he died, and I asked him to cut, like, I said, what do you think of the book, Dad? And he pointed to the last line and he said, it's a bit soppy. So I went into the kitchen and I said to my mum, does he like the book? Because I'm, bear in mind, you write a book about your dad, you want to, you, and it's the last chance you'll ever get. You want your dad to like your book, right? So I went into the kitchen and I said, does he like the book? And she said, he cried all the way through it when he was reading it. So I thought, oh, this is getting silly. So I thought I'll try one more time. I asked my sister. I said, Jane, go and ask him, what does he make of the book? And she came back and her exact words were, he's really surprised that he comes out of the book as a fucking legend. So that maybe tells you everything about my dad and I. We'd been through lots of rough times. We had lots of fights. We had all the usual stuff you have on a farm between the generations. And we came out the other side of it. And it ended good, actually. It ended good. I got to say the things that I cared about. The reason I'm telling you that is because my dad being ill actually informed this passage that I'm about to read. And since the book came out, I've had 6 or 7 letters, including one last week, actually, from people who'd read this passage at somebody they loved's funeral, a farm worker or a farming father or somebody else. And that sort of blows your mind a little bit. You think, I didn't imagine anything like that would happen. Anyway, this is the passage. There is no beginning and there is no end. The sun rises and falls each day. The seasons come and go. The days, months and years alternate through sunshine, rain, hail, wind, snow and frost. The leaves fall each autumn and burst forth again each spring. The earth spins through the vastness of space. The grass comes and goes with the warmth of the sun. The farms and the flocks endure bigger than the life of a single person. We're born, we live our working lives and die, passing like the oak leaves that blow across our land in the winter. We're each a tiny part of something enduring, something that feels to me solid, real and true. Our farming way of life has roots deeper than 5,000 years into the soil of this landscape. And you can see that landscape. If I can not curse the technology. So that's actually my dad. I should tell you something else funny as well, which is one of the things that helped me to realize I wanted to write a book and also probably helped me to sell books was the fact that I have a Twitter account. Put your hand up if you use Twitter. Okay, hello if you're Twitter friends of mine, hello. About 5 years ago, I started tweeting pictures from the farm. Crikey, it's hot in here, isn't it? It's like clipping sheep in here. About 5 years ago, I started tweeting pictures from the farm. Nothing complicated. It was pictures of my dogs and pictures of my sheep and pictures of the work and answering people's questions and trying to explain what we do. For the first 18 months, I sort of did it secretly. I didn't put my name on it. I called myself Herdy Shepherd as a sort of way of hiding. And I took all of my pictures while I'm working with my dad without him noticing, because I thought he's going to hate this. And so a lot of my early pictures are from behind my dad. Actually, before the end, he'd completely changed his view of it. So he went to the auctions and he was selling sheep, and the other older farmers were telling him that they were following me on Twitter and that was doing a really good thing, sort of sticking up for farmers, explaining what we do. So at that point, he was sort of claiming it was all his idea, which made me laugh. But that's my son, Isaac. He doesn't look too sure about farming life, does he? You look at all. We'll all wait and see whether he chooses to be a farmer or not. That's actually his sheep, Moss, and that was the first sheep he ever lambed. That's after he'd wiped the goo and the slime off his trousers, onto his trousers. And I'm very, very lucky. I mean, when I was growing up, I hated the fact I couldn't be the boss of the farm, right? I'm your typical 20-year-old. I think I know the lot. It's my turn. Get out the way, Dad. Get out the way, Granddad. I'm coming through. I'm going to be the best farmer that's been on this place. Get out of my way. 22 years later, I'm 42, turning 43 soon. I've realized that that's just the completely wrong way of looking at it. It's a 20-year-old ways of looking at it. The 42-year-old way of looking at it is I got to share my father and my grandfather's life. I was more or less their best friends. I worked with them every day. I had more arguments with them than anybody else on the planet, but I got to share it with them. And I think that's there's something important about that and something beautiful about that, that when people are on the land and they're in families and they're fixed to a certain place, they're passing a lot of knowledge and love and affection and care from one generation to the next. And I'm very grateful I had those two generations before me, a big part of my life. I didn't realize at the time what a privilege it was. And I'm sort of doing my best I can to do it with my kids, really, to pass all of that on. And one of the things that really touched me very deeply when my father was dying, and touched my wife Helen as well, was when my father found out he was dying, we said, "What do you want to do, Dad? Do you want to go on holiday? You must be somewhere you've never been. Do you want to go to some fancy restaurant? What are the things on your bucket list?" There's nothing on my dad's bucket list. My dad's bucket list was carry on doing the same stuff every single day. So for the remainder of his life, he went and did all the shepherding. He did the things he did. And he spent quite a lot of time taking Isaac and my two daughters, Molly and Bea, to mend gates and put walls up and teach them how to disrespect me in a way that only a grandfather can. So we have various gates on our farm, and my kids will point out, they'll say, "That gate's hung properly, Dad. Granddad said you'd never make such a good job of that one." So, and that's my daughter, Molly. And we're actually incredibly lucky. About an hour ago, I was asked by Radio Wiltshire to talk about the differences between this landscape and my own. And this is a beautiful landscape. It has a beautiful history and a beautiful farming culture. But it's, I think I'm right in saying, it's considerably changed from 100 years ago. There's a lot of change. And that's because technologies have changed, and the way that people farm here has had to change. We live in a really strange place where the degree of change is very, very minimal. So I have a quad bike that takes me up the mountain, but when I get halfway up the mountain, I have to abandon the quad bike, and then I just jump off and I'm a man with a crook and a dog again. When we're at home, the whole cycle of work that I do is exactly the same cycle of work that my father and my grandfather did. There's no other way to farm the Lake District Mountains. You either farm them with sheep the way that people have done for 1,000 years plus, or you give up and leave. That's really your two options. There isn't an option with technology. There isn't an option with machines. And one of the things I love most about my life at the moment is seeing my kids come through, particularly my two daughters who are 11 and 9. And they're both, I don't know whether they'll be farmers or not, that's up to them. But they're both really, really good young shepherdesses. They can both lamb sheep. They know how to hold sheep at shows. That's actually Molly's sheep. She has two ewes. First lamb she ever has. Gets second prize at the most important Herdwick show in the Lake District. I've never got second prize with any of my sheep at that show. So the grin on her face is another generation of Rebanks is thinking they're beating me, which is great. So the kind of sheep that we breed are Herdwick sheep. The local myth is that they came on a boat with the Vikings. It's just a myth. All the historians laugh at us for about 200 years about this myth. That can't possibly be true. And then in about 2005, the Sheep Trust did some DNA testing of Herdwick sheep, and what did they discover? They're largely unrelated to most of the other English sheep breeds, and genetically, their closest relatives are on the islands that the Vikings came from. In Norway, Iceland, the Wadden Sea of Denmark, they're very, very un-English sheep. Their sheep are almost certainly, a large part of their genetics came on a boat with people from the far north. And a lot of the words do as well, so I loved in my book being able to share a lot of the language that we use, a lot of which is understood more easily in Norway than it is here. So if I say to you, "I'm Garnyamen," Garnyam, sorry, the Cumbrian version is Garnyam, the Norwegian version is Garnyamen. And when I went to Norway about a month ago, I love it. I call it a dialect bingo. They understand about half of the things that I say to my friends. So a stream is a beck. It's a beck in Norway. A fell, a mountain, is a fjell in Norway. So there's this amazing sort of cultural bubble in and around the Lake District where the continuation of the work has led to the continuation of the language and a continuation of a kind of culture around that work. And a lot of people may not like me saying this, but I think culturally for the last 250 years, we've thought of the Lake District as the most English of landscapes, the sort of romanticized, idealized landscape. I actually think it's the least English landscape if you're judging it against the rest of England. It's very alien in very many ways, the way it's farmed and the way the landscape's managed compared to places like Wiltshire, which have a very different history. And those are my dogs. So we've got Floss and Tan and Meg and Skye. Skye actually doesn't live with me anymore. He's gone to Scotland. He was always going to Skye, so we trained him and then he went. Meg and Floss and Tan were working with me this morning on the farm, so we had a sort of 5 o'clock start this morning to get around all of my sheep, and then we jumped in the car, and my God, it's a long way to Wiltshire. Bloody hell, I could have got to France quicker. It's a long way, but it's not all bad. Those of you that have read my book will know that I have a sort of funny personal story, which is I grew up this farm kid. I thought farming was everything. I loved my father, my grandfather, although I'd never have told them. And all I wanted to be was a farmer and a shepherd. And the sort of cultural values of the household I grew up are that if you're a good shepherd, you've done it. There isn't another thing outside of that. But it didn't work out like that. In my 20s, we were going broke. I didn't get on very well with my father. I sort of went off and had this sort of half of a life in the modern world. I did other jobs, and then I came back to it all later on. But a real turning point for me was when I was 17. I was working at home on the farm. I now sound like I'm about 150 years old. I worked at home on the farm for £40 a week. What the hell? £40 a week? And my kids are going to be like, Dad, you didn't live in the 18th century. But apparently I did financially. So I lived at home, worked on the farm, and I'd left school when I was 15. I don't think anyone's allowed to leave school when they're 15, but I did, and I worked on the farm. And there wasn't a lot to do. On Saturday nights, you could jump in one of your friend's cars and you could go around the car park in the local town trying to impress girls. It doesn't impress girls, but you think it does when you're 17. And the rest of the week, what do you do in the evenings? Well, I ran out of things to do, particularly because this was the days when there was only one TV in most houses. Still in the 1980s, there was still only one TV in our house. And guess who controlled the TV channel? Dad. Okay, so I've had enough of this dude through the day, and then he's telling me I can't watch what I want to watch on television. What else is there to do in the house? Turns out my mum has a bookcase full of amazing books that she got from her school teacher father. He was a teacher at Bury Grammar School in Lancashire. He'd fought in Burma in the Second World War. His father had been killed on the Somme in the First World War. He fought in Burma in the Second World War. I never met this man. He died when my mum was 15 years old. But he left me something really special. He never knew me either, but he left a shelf, sort of three shelffuls of books in this bookcase, amazing books. So I'd never been interested in books at all at school, but I start reading these books. I set off with A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway, who I've never heard of, but I read this book and think, Christ, books are good, aren't they? And then I read W.H. Hudson's A Shepherd's Life, which is written about the landscape here, and I think, Christ, books are really good. And it's about Wiltshire, and that's why I'm excited to be here. And I go through this. So the first 30 or 40 books I read are some of the best books ever written. And I don't realize that this is a fluke, that I've just got a granddad with impeccable taste. It's only later when I read thousands of other books and discover that he handed me all the best ones and that most reading isn't that good. But a real breakthrough for me was reading this book, A Shepherd's Life, by W.H. Hudson. It was written in this area. About a shepherd called, how do you say it, Caleb? Caleb? Caleb. It's not a name we have where I'm from, but Caleb Balcombe, who I think was from Winterbourne Bishop. Yeah. Oh, you haven't been studying your Hudson, have you? Okay. For those of you that don't know that book, some of you will, it's an absolutely beautiful book about this shepherd telling the story of his life in about 1900, and he's telling a story of a life that sweeps back for about 60 years before that. You can read the book to hear that story, but what really blew me away was I'd thought books were about other people. Yeah, written by other people, for other people, about other people. And suddenly I read this book and I'm like, oh, you can write great books about shepherds. Yeah, you can write a book about my granddad. You can write a book about my dad. So by the time I get sort of 18, 19, 20 years old, I have the most unlikely of ambitions. I want to be Ernest Hemingway and I want to be the best shepherd in the Lake District. No one's ever actually done this, of course, but that's my weird 20-year-old dream. And the sad thing is, for the next 15 years after that, I failed spectacularly at both of those things. I couldn't get on with my dad on the farm. I had to leave, and that didn't work out for a while. And I couldn't crack the writing thing at all. I actually wasn't brave enough to try. I was a chicken. So all my writing was in scribbly little notebooks in my bedroom, and nobody ever saw it. And it's only much later, when I'm sort of 25, 26, And I meet someone amazing who's my wife now, Helen, and she sort of tells me to grow up. Stop being a jerk. Stop showing off with all your silly friends on a Friday night. Buckle down. You're actually reasonably smart. I won't claim any more than reasonably, but you're reasonably smart. You love books. You love writing. It's time to grow up and do the things that you're meant to do. Get over yourself. I'd been really embarrassed. I thought, oh, my God, I can't tell everybody that I love books. So in my mid-20s, she sent me back to school, basically. So I went to adult education classes. This is while I'm working on the farm. And I got a quite amazing teacher at one of those adult education classes. And within 3 weeks of going there, he said I should apply to Oxford or Cambridge. to go and do a history degree. This was just completely weird to me because I hadn't even got any GCSEs at that point. I'm completely blagging it. And I got an interview to go and had a really weird experience because when I got there, I was in the first year of a two-year course, adult education course, doing my A-levels. And I was applying for the year after. And I got a letter about 2 days after I got back saying, don't bother with the A-levels, come in 3 weeks' time. Yeah. And I got that letter from the postman, who was a lad that I knocked about with, who was like a friend of mine, sort of working-class friend of mine. And I told him this, and he looked at me and he went, you're taking the piss, you're an idiot like me. So my friends were quite surprised, because most of my friends, even my best friends, didn't know that I read loads of books. I just didn't tell them. I was embarrassed about reading books. How absurd is that? But never mind, I was. So it took me a long time. It took me the next 20 years to work all of this out, to work out how you write a book, to work out the sort of focus of it. The truth is, if I'd written the book in my 20s, it would have been an angry young man book, and it wouldn't have been very nice about my dad. Yeah? So sometimes maybe waiting's better, isn't it? So it actually became a grown-up book in the end. It was a book about all the things I'd got wrong and all the things my dad had got wrong, and then we grew up and came out the other side of it. The other... Too many things to think about here. Talking, clicking, book, pictures. So that's my sheep just after they've been sheared, going down the lane. That's Floss, who's a complete tart. I'm not really bothered myself about being famous, but I find it quite funny that my sheepdog's famous. When Floss had puppies, we put a six-second clip of them onto a social media sharing site called Vine, and 1.1 million people watched the puppies be born. Yeah, which is bonkers. And like every time any journalists come to the farm, two of my dogs skulk off to the barn. They don't want any attention. They're sick of people coming to our farm. Floss pushes herself to the front and completely owns every single photo shoot. They're two of my friends. They're also two of the most cantankerous men you'll ever meet. The man on the left-hand side is called Mason Weir, and he farms in the valley just up from us. And the lad with the ginger hair is called Joseph Weir, and he's one of the best young shepherds in the Lake District. If he was doing this talk, he'd tell you he's the best young shepherd in the Lake District. I'm still claiming that. Okay. And that's my sheep and my neighbour's been taken back to High Row at the end of the fell. One of the things that I find absolutely stunning about our way of life is that the sheep on our mountain are genetically the descendants of the sheep that went back to that mountain 1,000 years ago, maybe 4,500 years ago. It's insane, isn't it? And they've had to go back every single year with somebody like me taking them up there. How many people on earth get to do the same thing in the same place as people did 4,500 years ago? That's completely bonkers, isn't it? And the mothers are teaching that there's no fences on the mountains. This is a huge expanse of open land. And the mother, the ewes, mother sheep are called ewes. I don't know why I forgot that for a moment. It's because I'm doing my South of England posh talk at the moment. If I was back in Cumbria, it would go back into dialect. I'm like, yeah, I need, no way. So the mothers take their daughters back to the fell and they teach them where to live on the fell. It's called hefting. Yeah. And so the mothers in my flock are currently teaching their daughters that this is the place on the mountain where we live. We don't stray to that mountain over there, even if there's more grass. We don't go to that other part. It's somebody else's. And the hefting is so strong on our fell because it's been so undisturbed for so long that I can literally find, not all of them, but I can find many of the individual sheep in the place where I know their mothers grazed. It's an absolutely remarkable thing. And in 2001, when the foot and mouth epidemic hit, it got within about 3 fields, the disease and the culling zone, of those mountains. It only had to travel about 3 more fields. It would have got onto the open fells and all of that was gone. That entire history, that sort of 1,000 to 4,500 years worth of genetics and story and culture and practices, all gone, finished. And a handful of very brave, very vocal people, vets and others, stopped that happening. And it's just amazing that it could have gone in our lifetime. I was told that there was a clock on the stage, but I'm damned if I can see a clock. Is that the clock there? 30, okay. I'm assuming it's going down and not up. Okay. Shut up, was that? Okay. Bear with me. The other thing that I love about our landscape is that although there's almost none of it in books, it has its own culture. It even has its own written culture and its own books. We have a shepherd's guide, which is this. So the first person to take their sheep into the mountains in our landscape, whenever that was in the distant past, didn't worry about marks too much. The minute the second flock turned up, you have to worry about the sheep identification. So the first guy says, I'm having the simplest mark. I'm just going to take the end off the ear. So the simpler the ear mark, even now, you know that it's the oldest flock in the valley. With every passing generation, as new flocks are added and things change and people disappear and new people come in, it gets ever more complex. So you end up with the sort of middle one on the far side. You end up with really, really complicated lug marks. For my whole life, I thought lug mark meant the mark in the lug, which you'd assume was what it meant, wouldn't you? It doesn't. Apparently lug is a contortion of a Norse word which meant law. It's the law mark. Yeah, and if you read the Icelandic sagas, they're fantastic about this stuff. If you break the rules, i.e. you steal somebody else's sheep in the Icelandic sagas, they go around and kill you. It's not quite that bad now, although there was somebody on the Pennines not far from us that we know who for about 20 or 30 years had been stealing people's sheep, had been abusing this system. It's all based on trust. It's all based on everybody being above board and honest. I've never known anybody cheat. In fact, we fall out with each other in the sheep pens trying not to claim any unmarked sheep, because your reputation for being honest and not being greedy is worth far more than the gain that you might get from claiming an individual sheep. But there was a family. I won't mention the names, actually, because I think it's disgusting what they did. But they cheated effectively. They were putting the sheep into the pens, and they were cutting out the horns that had the horn marks on. They were cutting out the tags, and they were pretending that they were their sheep. And the really despicable bit of this was that they were blaming it on some other guy. For about 20 years, this other guy had his reputation besmirched because this family, who were a very respectable family of shepherds, had been stealing sheep. I'm giving the impression that we're all crooks. We're not. That's a very, very, very rare example. The other book is the flock book. So in the historic breeds of sheep, and in many of the modern ones, the pedigree of the sheep is recorded in a book which comes out each year. And the greatest thing you can do in the Swaledale breed or the Herdwick breed is to breed a sheep in your particular year, in the year, that's so good it gets captured forever in one of the five or six photographs in the flock book. Yeah? And on the winter nights, a lot of the old shepherds, including my father and my grandfather, sat and studied this book, and they go back through these weird pedigrees way back to the 1950s and 60s, and they're scholars about this thing that we do. And one of my favourite writers about the Lake District, even though she didn't write directly very much about it at all, is Beatrix Potter. And what I actually like about her is not the children's books, even though they're lovely. What I love is that she came up with her money to the Lake District. She bought one farm initially, ended up buying 14 farms, and she fell in love with all this stuff. And one of the things I find really funny about it, slightly frustrating if you're an editor, is they couldn't get any more books out of her. So there's a whole correspondence going on with Frederick Warne and co. You know, sort of give us another one of these best-selling books all around the world. She's off at Eskdale Sheep Show, or she's at Keswick Sheep Show, and she's in the sheep pens with her shepherd, Tom Story, trying to breed these amazing sheep. She's gone completely native, and I just love that. I think it's hilarious. Don't tell my editor that I'm struggling to write my next book either because I'm in the sheep pens. Yeah. So that's one of our lambs that was born this spring. The Herdwicks are born black, and then they go sort of paler grey as they get older. My two daughters are proper comedians. They'll often grab my phone, and while I'm doing something sensible down the phone, they'll be capturing pictures of sheep sticking their tongues out and things like that. But the point is that the Lake District is actually one of the toughest landscapes on Earth where sheep live out all year round. Okay? Bear with me for a second on that. There are lots of sheep live in harder landscapes with worse winters further north than the Lake District around the world, but they don't live outside through the winter. So if you go to Norway, Sweden, and other places, they live in the little wooden barns next to the house. So they don't have to be incredibly tough to survive those really tough winters. And the Lake District has a particularly kind of snotty weather. We would call it snotty in Cumbria, which is cold and wet and relentless, that sometimes lasts for 6 or 7 months. And it's actually lousy weather for sheep. It gives them pneumonia and other things. So if you take most of the native breeds of sheep from England, certainly from the south of England, you put them onto my fell, you leave them out all year round, there aren't many left when you go back next year. Yeah, there's absolute carnage, and the attrition rate would be terrific. The Herdwicks have been selectively bred and have evolved, because there's a great deal of natural evolution in it as well, to be incredibly tough. Okay, so their job is to survive these really horrible weathered winters, And then as soon as the grass starts to grow in May and April, to drop a lamb onto the ground and then to feed it as well as you can and get it as big as you can before October when the grass will disappear again. That's the whole system. And in the early 20th century, they were replaced by another breed in much of that area by the Swaledale. And the Swaledale breeds North Country mules. Just out of interest, the farmers that are here, who has North Country mules? Okay, so for those of you that don't know what we're talking about, a lot of the farmers in the south of England travel to places like the Pennines and the Lake District every year. They travel to little auction marts like Lazenby and Hexham and Penrith and Carlisle, and they buy the daughters of the fells. And one of the disadvantages of the Herdwick is that it doesn't breed that crossbred, that hybrid. The Swaledale does. So in the early 20th century, there was a sort of displacement of them. There is lots of people, and Beatrix Potter is amazing. A lot of people think she saved the Herdwick breed. That's not quite true. The truth is the Herdwick breed are actually the only ones that can live in those really tough central fells and survive it all year round. So they would have been there anyway. They're actually the only commercial option that's left. That's the lane just above my house and taking the sheep back up to the high ground. That's one of the best tubs that I've ever bought. So I don't know how it works down here with your sheep farming, but in the Lake District, the prestige or the status that you have as a shepherd is about how good your best sheep are. And one of the ways that you prove that is by selling the male sheep, the tups, in the autumn. So there's an enormous amount of competition to try and turn out those amazing looking tups in the autumn. And the way that you improve a flock of sheep like ours is you can't buy better females because they're not hefted to the particular place in the mountain. You have to buy the ram, the tup that comes in, to change them and improve them. And what I didn't explain before is because those sheep have been hefted to that place on the open mountain for so long, they don't belong to the shepherd, they belong to the farm. Again, baffling to anyone that doesn't farm in a place like ours. But when people leave our landscape, they leave the sheep, the hefted sheep, on the farm in situ. You buy the sheep with the farm. And the National Trust owns many farms, I think 92 farms in our area, and many of them have landlord flocks on them. So the sheep belong to the farm, not the shepherd, and you're renting the flock of sheep as well as the farm. Could this get any weirder? I'm not sure it could, but that's how it works. Bear with me. Doesn't know how many pictures he's got. He's a complete amateur. One of the people I wrote about in the book was my grandfather. Said a lot about my dad, but my grandfather was sort of my hero when I was growing up. Grandfathers are good, aren't they? Put your hand up if your grandfather was your hero. Okay, there's six of us. Okay. I was lucky. I had a really, really good one. He was really cool. He didn't comply by any rules. He did whatever he liked. He was completely free and slightly chaotic. My grandmother said he was a lunatic, but I just thought he was wonderful. I was born in late July 1974 into a world that centered on an old man and his two farms. He was a proud farmer called William Hugh Rebanks, Huey to his mates, granddad to me. He had a rough, whiskery face when you kissed him goodnight. He smelt of sheep and cattle and only had one yellow tooth, but he could clean the meat off a lamb chop with it like a jackal. I'm going to stop in a moment because I'm going to let you do lots of questions. And rather than ramble on, I shall let you ask questions and I'll try and answer them in an interesting way. But I've just been incredibly fortunate. I feel like somebody that lucked out in life. I got to live, you know, all the things I said before. I got to live in this amazing place surrounded by people I love and respect. And I'm just very, very lucky. And then to write a book about it and tell everybody else about this thing that you love and for other people to react so warmly to it and to love it and share it with me is an absolute privilege and an honour. I'm not quite sure why I've got this lucky. Between the ages of 20 and 40, I thought I was one of the world's greatest losers, so it's quite nice to discover that I've actually done a couple of things that are okay.
Well, that's it for today, but there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk. or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.